Am I recording?
What's the point of everything? Everything is vanity.
No, we fear God and obey his commandments. There you go.
Yeah, always vanity. What's the point? We all die. We and the animals, we all die.
You're feeling very ecclesiastic at the moment, are you?
Who knows if the spirit goes up or down?
Who does know? All right.
No, I was reading Ecclesiastics last week, which put me in kind of a bit of a mood.
What's it called in Hebrew again?
Kohelet.
Kohelet, yeah.
Yeah. Puts life in perspective.
Yeah, it does a bit. Around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for Light of the Prophets on Truth to You. That's truth number two letter U.org, where you can sign up for the weekly newsletter and keep up to date via iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm Jono, and joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, my friend.
All is vanity.
Go ahead,
give up all hope.
We've just been talking about Ecclesiastes. You're in a very Ecclesiastes mood, but you've got to snap out of it.
Because with the type of news I received last week, do me a favor. Puts life in perspective.
You're all right. What, do you want to talk about that?
Nah, it's all good. Don't worry. It's just there are types of news that when you receive them, the first feeling is you got slapped in the face. And when you're looking around to somewhere to hold your hand, when you get slapped in the face, he discovers no one's there. It's like another slap in the face. Maybe.
And so, that's right. And so what do you do? What's your last resort? You read Kohelet. That's what you do.
No, but I read Kohelet before I got this piece of news. Nothing to worry about. We can take care of it. It's just very simple. Don't worry. I'm okay. I just need people to pray for me that I'm able to take care of this problem. But it means good. I have to deprive myself from a lot of things. So. Yeah.
So you should.
And with those details, we shall continue to say all is vanity and we all die in the end. And really the whole point is to be happy with what we have.
And to fear God and obey his commandments.
Exactly. You know, it just puts life in perspective, you know, and
you'll be fine.
Man.
You'll be fine. Snap out of it because last week, Yoel, I had a little bit of a dilemma, and I asked you about it, and we did talk about it a little bit. Wasn't quite satisfied. Not that we said anything wrong. We were quite right in what we talked about, but I just wanted to just go through it in a little bit more detail, and I dug up a couple of things, and I just want to run it by you. Now, we mentioned last week how Solomon disposed Abiathar as the priest and put in his place Zadok. Now, Abiathar did not die. The high priesthood didn't pass on to Zadok and his family in that way that it usually would. And so that was a little curious. And you did mention you floated the idea of politics within the book of Samuel, and that's fair enough as well.
Oh, yeah. I was also in the middle of reading Richard Friedman's book about who wrote the Bible. So it made me think a little bit about the issue of the politics. I mean, reading between the lines a little.
I did a little bit of digging. I just want to run this. I want to run this by you, and I want to see what you think about this. Because if we go to, for example, 1 Chronicles chapter 24, then we see it says, "Now these are the divisions."
No, the problem, by the way, that we really have to be careful with Chronicles, is that Chronicles tends to try to smooth out issues. So
stop Koheleting everything that I'm talking about.
Koheleting? No, it's not Koheleting. It's just a fact. The Book of Chronicles tends to try to smooth out things that it didn't like.
Well, this
so
is
what were you talking about? What Chronicles? Wait, where?
So you tell me if this is a bit of smoothing. Or
where?
Not.
Where? Says, where? Where? Where?
Well, we start from the beginning of chapter 24.
24. Just a second. I'm getting old, okay?
You're not. I'm 10 years older than you. What are you talking about?
So what? I'm older. I was born 70 years. Everyone used to complain that I was contemplating too many things at a young age. And my dad used to turn around to me and say to me, "You were born 70. I said, "Yeah, I sometimes feel like one."
Well, that'll make you 100.
That will probably make me even older.
Maybe. Chapter 24. First Chronicles.
Let's get on with it.
It says, now these are the divisions, Yoel. These are the divisions of the sons of Aaron. The sons of Aaron were Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar. And, of course, the first two died. This is when they offered strange fire, right? They were incinerated. They had no children. Therefore, Eleazar and Itamar ministered as priests. And then David, with Zadok, who was, you know, he was the son of the sons of Eleazar, and Ahimelech of the sons of Itamar. Now, that's the piece of information that I was missing. That's what I was looking for. Ahimelech is of the sons of Itamar, because if we then go, Yoel, to Numbers chapter 24.
So wait, so if Eviatar is from the house of Ahimelech, he's from the sons of Itamar, which means the house of Eli were descendants, probably descendants of Itamar,
that's right,
which makes him illegitimate to be high priest because he's supposed to go through Eleazar.
You the man. That's so, exactly my. So let me just read that.
Okay. So what, basically, what's going on here? Even if it's not, even if we say it's a smoothing out, it's a very, very important. It's a very, very, that's fine. We're fine with that. The point being made here is that what David actually did is he corrected a mistake that was made somewhere along the line. That why are the sons of Itamar the high priest? It's supposed to be the sons of Eleazar.
This is the thing. But now are they? Now I'm the one who said that he was high priest. Is he actually priest, or are they just Cohen acting as priests? Are they assuming the role of high priest, or are they simply acting as priests?
But even so, based on the logic that's used in the Book of Kings, where it says that he cast Eviatar away to complete the curse on the house of Eli, okay? Even so, the house of Eli was the high priest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was the officiating high priest. So this is the house. This is the family of Eli.
Yeah,
he was officiating as high priest, so they weren't actually considered to be illegitimate. They're not supposed to be the high priest. But it could be that at that time, somehow they established, again, this was a time where did they really have one place of worship or one? This, again, the whole history of tabernacles and temples in Israel and the priesthood and everything, it's a bit more tricky than what we think.
It was in Shiloh and then it was in Nov, and so
there was Shiloh and there was something at Nov and there was something in Shechem and there were different altars in different places and people were officiating as priests even if they were not priests, and there was a whole mess going on. And this is what David was trying to organize. They were trying to go like, okay, who are the real priests?
True.
So David was probably correcting different things.
But when you say, that David was trying to correct a couple of things, we know that Solomon made the point of saying that, well, it says, as you pointed out last week, that he put Zadok in to fulfill, you know, what the prophecy in regards to Eli's line. But also in addition to that, there seems to be this one in Numbers 25, verse 11, says, from verse 10, it says, then Yehovah spoke to Moses, saying, Pinchas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned back my wrath from the children of Israel because he was zealous. My zeal was among them so that I did not consume the children of Israel in my zeal. Therefore say, behold, I give to him my covenant of peace, and it shall be to him and his descendants after him a covenant of an everlasting priesthood. There's the everlasting priesthood, because he was zealous for his God and made atonement for the children of Israel. But there is there's the everlasting priesthood, and we know that Zadok follows not just through Eleazar, but also through Pinchas, right?
Oh, yeah, the opinion is that, well, actually, no, the opinion, it says that Pinchas became the high priest.
Mm. And so there's a couple of things, like you say, there's a couple of things corrected there, and I don't know, just when I found that out, that put my mind at ease. We can move on.
Okay, now we can move on. All is vanity. What are you talking about? There's no point for anything.
Now it happened. This is 1 Samuel chapter 24. It happened when Saul turned from following the Philistines that he was told, saying, take note, David is in the wilderness of En Gedi. And then Saul took 3,000 chosen men. 3,000? Really? He took 3,000? Wow. From Israel.
You have to remember, he's obsessed. He's paranoid. He's mad.
He is obsessed because David, we know, has got about 600 now, but he's got 3,000 for Saul. And he went to seek David and his men in the rocks of the wild goats. Now, is that just another name for En Gedi? I mean, the spring of the kid? Rocks
no,
of Wild
it's Tzurei Yaelim. It's a completely different word. Ein Gedi and Yaelim. Yaelim are wild goats and Tzurim are rocks. This is a, but again, if you ever see the area of Ein Gedi, you also have like peaks there, which wild goats run around there.
There, you know what? I was thinking about it today, and there is some, I remember like boulders that looked like if a fly landed on them, they would just roll down and crush all the tourists. Really, there was some that were just hanging over, and I thought, you know, I wonder how stable they are. But yeah, I did see some goats. You know what? I'm really happy today. I bought a, I purchased another buck to service my, my three, goats. We're going to start milking again and all of that. It's good fun. Anyway, so actually they don't do that. They go, like that. So
your goats have a problem because real goats go also bah.
No, these ones do that. I have conversations with my goats.
Yeah, they, your goats have a problem.
No, they stop and they look at me and they go, and I
yeah, goats also have another noise that they make.
We can well there is well we used to have a Nubian that your, used to go. We had Nubians that went like that.
Your goats are defective.
Anyway, so he came to the sheep folds by the road where the cave was, and Saul went in to attend to his needs. What does that mean?
Toilet.
He went to the toilet.
Yeah. But it's very interesting that the text says, it says, V'yavo Shaul lehasechet raglav. So mesechet raglav, we saw this term, if I remember correctly, we saw this term in Judges.
Judges 3:24?
Yeah, this is 24. This is 3:24 says, V'yomu ach mesechu et raglav b'chadar ha-mikare. Okay, so mikara. So it's actually the word masach or mesech or lehasech. It's from the root of sachach, which is to cover. It's the same root as sachach as sukkah, basically.
Oh, really?
And yeah, and it's actually they're saying that there's a sometimes in certain places, a few places in the Bible where it uses a reversed language, where instead of saying one thing, it says the opposite. Like for example, in Job, it said blessing God, what it really means to curse. Mm-hmm. So here it says he's covering himself, but what he really is doing is he's exposing himself. But to not talk about him exposing himself, they would write it a bit differently.
Say the opposite, yeah. Okay.
And say the opposite. By the way, what's very interesting is, for example, the Qumran group, they actually used to cover themselves. They had this law that when you dig the hole and everything, you also have like this thing that it's like a wrap skirt that they used to wrap around them and keep like on a cover over the ground that, you know, that everything is hidden. And even to this very day, for example, there are some, not a lot, but there are some people who, when they go to the bathroom, the amount of exposure is minimal. Mm-hmm. And the Talmud talks about, you know, not exposing more, you know, because they used to wear skirts or dress type of things. So, you know, they used to lift it. So they have rules like don't lift more like this here on one side and not more than that and then that on the other side to minimize the exposure. In other words, don't sit there in your birthday suit. So today, even today, you have people that, you know, when they go to the bathroom, and I've actually met people who do this, not that I noticed anything in the bathroom. We just had a discussion about it. If you remember something, we can have some of the weirdest discussions in the rabbinic world. We don't treat it in a childish way. It's part of life. It's a reality. And you sometimes have to have discussions about these things. The same thing here. We're just studying the Talmud, and we mentioned the whole thing of not exposing more. And someone said to me, yeah, I do that. And I said, you're completely mad. You know?
So even in the privacy of their own bathroom, there are people who practice an extra amount of modesty, if you like.
Yeah, they practice an extra amount of modesty. And actually, the issue of modesty, I mean, it really becomes kind of more and more. Like, for example, so there are women, it says in the Talmud that women are supposed to cover their hair. But really what the Talmud says, they only have to cover their hair when they're outside. Inside the house, they don't have to. So today, a lot of Orthodox women cover their hair in the house. And there's even a story in the Talmud about a woman called Kimchit who used to replace her head cover when she was underneath her blanket.
Wow.
That's how super duper pious people try to become. But I keep on saying this is what we call mass post-traumatic stress. A group of people as an entity start exaggerating things because they're trying to repent, so they overdo it. It's like
They impose rules upon rules, and it gets more and more stressful, right?
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. So this is something, it's just, you know, Second Temple Judaism was post-traumatic stress. This is why, you know, there's a lot of weird stuff that comes out from that period. I, for example, keep on telling people, you know, with all due respect to the Book of Jubilees and the Book of Enoch and everything, these are all things which are expression of the trauma of the first of destruction of the first temple period. Mm-hmm. Everyone's trying to discover the truth about everything. Mm-hmm. And really, this is why certain books were canonized and certain books were completely ignored, because certain books ask the real questions, like the Book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastics. They ask the real questions about, okay, sin and everything. And then you have books like the Book of Enoch or the Book of Jubilees, where they're trying to prove that the mistakes were, for example, with the issue of a calendar, we celebrate at the wrong times. No. It wasn't that. It was an issue of not following the Torah. Mm-hmm. And this is why, for example, and I it was really funny, because I even heard a professor in a Christian college say this: if you really want to understand the Bible, you have to, first of all, read the Torah. If you're going to ignore the Torah, you will not understand anything that goes on in the rest of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And even the New Testament.
True. Context. So Saul goes in to attend to his needs, and it says David and his men were staying in the recesses of the cave. Not a lot of ventilation in the cave.
Yeah, about that. You know, it's just, every time I read this passage, I go like, this is such a weird... that they're sitting in there, they're hiding, and he's doing his business. It just, every time first I read it, it's strange.
First he comes in, surely what goes through their head is, oh man, we've been discovered, he's there, and just outside the mouth of the cave, there'll be the 3,000 men. But no, he continues to wander in, and then all of a sudden it's like, oh no, dude, no, please, oh no.
Yeah, every time I read this, I feel like this is such an awkward. It's kind of like, what's wrong? Something completely wrong here with the picture. But look at it. They're keeping straight faces. They're not, sorry, cracking jokes or anything.
No, well, it's serious stuff. Yeah. Once they cotton on that he's just there to relieve himself, it says then the men of David said to him, this is the day of which Jehovah said to you, behold, I will deliver your enemy into your hands, that you may do to him, go and do to him as it seems good to you. And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Now, it happened afterwards that David's heart troubled him because he had cut Saul's robe.
Wait, you're, can you read the end of verse 4 again? I think you're missing some words.
And David arose and secretly cut off a corner of Saul's robe.
Okay. Yeah, okay. I thought you were missing the word secretly.
No, so I might have missed it, but he said... He said to his men...
You read it. It's just again, Hebrew syntax. I'm not looking at an English Bible. I'm looking into a Hebrew Bible.
Sure.
So sometimes when you read the translation, you know, I'm going like, okay, I'm just trying to make sure you're not missing any words, but then sometimes I keep on forgetting
You're using both sides of your brain.
Yeah, I have to use both sides. Time. Yeah, and so sometimes I miss out on words. I'm like, did they actually say that word? Because it might be an important word. So David's sneaking up. He's actually, if you mention this, he's sneaking up towards Saul. But it's
I imagine he's not too far away from him in the first place, because Saul wants a bit of privacy. He probably moves into the cave sufficiently. They're sort of hidden back into a little pocket of the cave, and he sneaks up behind him. But
I think there's more of an importance here about how he snuck up, more to the issue of cutting off the corner of the garment, the kanaf. It's very interesting, because cutting off corners of garments were symbols of first of all, if you remember, it happened with Samuel. Samuel goes and he walks up and he tears the corner or the skirt of the garment, and he says to him, "This God has torn off from you the kingdom of Israel and given it to someone else." But also, you know, he walks up and he cuts it, and first of all, the cutting itself is a very symbolic act. Because first of all, cutting in the ancient world, cutting off the rim of a garment was actually a symbol of breaching a treaty. The treaty's been canceled.
Truly,
because what they used to do when they did treaties is that it depends what kind of treaty it was, but they would exchange clothing, exchange weapons. They would sometimes even exchange blood by cutting their hands and like shaking on it. And the garments were a symbol of the treaty. Now, obviously, they also wrote down many of the treaties. This is why we have so many of them. For example, the Hittites. The Hittites were the masters of treaties. It's really funny. It's like a Hittite treaty was like the equivalent of waging war against someone. very, very strange. There's loads of treaties from the Hittites. And they were very elaborate and complex. But the thing is that when you cut off, when you tore off the corner, for example, if it's the garment that you were received from this king, if you tore it off and, for example, sent it to him, basically it was a sign of, okay, now we're enemies. So it's very interesting that David actually cuts off the corner, because it's very, very symbolic.
And I asked you this question when Shaul tears the corner of Samuel's robe, and I asked you this question, and I ask it to you again: is it possible? Is it conceivable that there was a tzitzit attached?
Again, it might be, it might not be. We don't really have a way of knowing. The word kanaf just means a skirt. The corner. I mean, again, this whole corner thing is a misunderstanding of the word kanaf. Okay. It's really the issue is the rim, the corner, the edges of it. It's not necessarily just, you know, four corners. You know, they didn't walk around with ponchos or something like that, or serapes or something like that. They walked around with most of them walked around either with just wrap on skirts or some kind of northeastern, you know, Assyrian, Babylonian style type of clothing if they were living in the north. And there are examples of this, for example, from Sancheriv's palace, where he exiled the tribes, and also all the palace from Nineveh.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the type of clothing they were wearing. Also very interesting that the women cover their heads in these images. But that's probably because it's a sign of mourning, not a sign of being modest or pious or something. But in any case... and also all the men are bearded. Real men do not shave.
That's amen. I'm with you there.
Yeah,
God created us with a beard, right?
But it's very interesting, culturally speaking. Also, not having a beard was actually kind of like a sign, as if you don't really have any manhood or no real respect or honor. And also people used to shave as a symbol of mourning. That was also one of the things that they did.
An enemy might shave one's enemy to dishonor them.
Yeah,
as we see,
we have a story like this here. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, also very interesting thing. It's like that video that someone posted on Facebook. You know, how does a real man shave? He doesn't. He doesn't shave. That's how a real man shaves.
Yeah, I love that video. But in any case, so David doesn't shave Saul, but he does cut off a piece of his robe. And then he says to his men, Yehovah forbid that I should do this thing to my master, the Lord's Messiah.
Yes, and your point is?
I'm just saying. I was just going to say that because...
There are plenty of people called Messiah in the Bible.
What are you talking about?
Including some characters that will go like, huh, he's a Messiah, like Kolosh.
No, look, in the Christian Bible... See, I read it like that, but in the Christian Bible, you only see it... what is it? 39 times it's in the Tanakh. But in the Christian Bible, it's only interpreted as Messiah twice. But in this case, here it says,
yeah, but again, this is a very, very simple question. You know, you're interpreting. So again, this is a situation where you interpret based on your own will and need, not necessarily what the word actually means. The word Mashiach means an anointed one.
That's what it means.
Okay, taking the word Messiah is just a Greekified corruption of the word Mashiach.
That's what it is.
And the word Mashiach is derived from the word Mashuach. Like, for example, Chalot Meshuchot Bashamin, you know, loaves of bread smeared with oil. You know,
smeared with oil.
Smeared. We say shmir.
Smeared with oil.
It's the Yiddish term. You know, it's basically anointed. So even the word Christ means to be anointed with oil.
Mm.
You know, Christos. It's the whole idea.
That's where we get christening from.
Exactly.
It's anointing.
Anointing with oil in this case. So first of all, Saul was anointed with oil.
He was.
But also, the word Mashiach was at one point used to indicate a chosen person.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily someone who was originally, yes, the original meaning of a word was someone who was anointed with oil.
Mm.
But it was borrowed later on to indicate a person who is chosen.
And generally, when people refer to "quote unquote" the Messiah, whether they're Christian or they're Jewish, they're talking about a king, a coming king of Israel, right?
But I find it very, very interesting that, for example, in the book of Ezekiel, he's not referred as the word Mashiach. He's referred as the word Nasi.
Mm-hmm.
Nasi is a governor or ruler. So the English translates as prince.
That's
because
right.
There is a word in the Bible for the word, kind of like Nasich does show up, Nasichei Adam, but Nasich is usually a person who's just a ruler. So Nasi is a high-ranking ruler. It's very interesting because, again, you know, it's the third temple and this is the Messianic period. This is like the end of everything and the mm-hmm. water's flowing from the temple and everything. And it's very interesting that he's not called Mashiach. He's referred mm-hmm. as Nasi.
Is in Ezekiel chapters 40 to 46, where he talks about
exactly. It's
that's
really
right.
Like, he's the character shows up like chapter 45, 46, I think.
We'll probably get there eventually.
And he also has children and servants. Yeah. It's really different than what some people think.
It's interesting. So he says, Yehovah forbid that I should do such a thing to my master Yehovah's Messiah, to stretch out my hand against him, seeing he is the Messiah of Yehovah. So David restrained his servants with these words and did not allow them to rise against Saul. And Saul got up from the cave and he went on his way.
Your thing says restrained?
It said restrained.
Yeah, the Hebrew says, Vayishasa David anashav bedevarim. He didn't restrain them. It says Vayishasa, the word shasa is to tear something. He spoke in a very strict way towards them.
Uh-huh.
He chastised them with words, basically,
because they would have been quick to do it, right?
Yeah, he just opened his mouth and let it all come out. So Vayishasa is not just to tell them don't do it. It's like being very, very, very harsh about it.
Mm-hmm.
How dare
strenuous.
You? Strenuous, exactly.
Yep, fair enough. And David
also is like to rip. He was like basically like ripping them as if he's shredding them with words.
Right. To rip into him, right. David also arose afterwards and went out of the cave, and he called to Saul, saying, "My lord, the king." And when Saul looked behind him, David stooped his face to the earth and bowed down. So he's still showing respect to the king.
Of course, he's showing respect to the king. This is part of the issue. They were creating a contrast here between David and Saul. They're both anointed.
They're both anointed. This is true. And so
they're both chosen by God. David is saying, well, as long as Saul's alive, I'm not king. I don't have any rights or anything as king. Yes, I was anointed. Yes, eventually I will become king. But at the moment, Saul is still alive, and he's the functioning king of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
So I have no right to do anything to him. But by the way, David is being extra pious here because he does have the right. First of all, he is the anointed one. He is basically the king. He actually functioned as a king more than Saul for a very, very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And if Saul's trying to attack him, he has all right to attack back and even kill Saul if he has to. But he won't. He won't for one very simple reason. He has no interest whatsoever to cause harm to anyone. This is really the issue with David. David is always trying to avoid the conflict. He's always trying to avoid the bloodshed. But if he has to go to war against Philistines, yes, he'll kill Philistines. That's not the issue. The issue is that he really is trying to be, as we can say, a king for everyone. It's like, for example, we're having the elections for the chief rabbi. We just replaced the chief rabbis here in Israel. They sit in their position for 10 years. It's very interesting that the two chief rabbis are actually sons of other rabbis who functioned as chief rabbis. But in any case, I'm not very pleased with the elections. But in any case, the point is very, very simple, that they kept on saying, like, you know, a rabbi for all of Israel, you can't do that. It doesn't work. And this is kind of the struggle that David's having. He's trying to be a king for everyone, even if it's people which are in conflict with one another. You know, so it bears out
in the following verses, because, and it's a very interesting conversation, an interesting exchange that happens here. And so he stoops his face towards the earth and bowed down. And David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of men who say, 'Indeed, David seeks your harm'? Look, this day your eyes have seen that Yehovah delivered you into my hand in the cave." And this, there's a few italics here. It says, "And someone urged me to kill you, but my eye spared you." Is that fair, do you think, in the Hebrew?
Yeah, I mean, it does show up here in the Hebrew.
it does. Okay, fair enough. Mm. And I said, I will not stretch up my hand against my Lord, for he is the Yehovah's Messiah. Moreover, now here he calls him my father. Moreover, well, my father is a
sign of respect and honor. It's like, you know, when Elisha dies, King Ahaz says, you know, my avi avi rechev Yisrael ufarasha, my father, the chariot of Israel and its horsemen. Mm-hmm. Basically, it's a sign of respect. My father, basically, you know, my strong man of my family, and the strong man of Israel, the strength of Israel.
And so he's on his best behavior, right? He's showing as much respect as he possibly can.
He's using the most courteous, most diplomatic language that exists.
Yeah. And he said, see in my, you know, I cut the corner off your robe in my hand for in that I cut off the corner of your robe, I did not kill you. Know and see that there is neither evil nor rebellion in my hand, and I have not sinned against you. Let you hunt my life to take it. And this is, and here it is, that he's not going to take it into his hands. He says in verse 12, yet let Yehovah judge between you and me, and let Yehovah avenge me on you. Now, that's seems a little clumsy in the English. How would you interpret that, verse 12?
That's basically what it said. You know, the Lord will judge between you and I, and if there's any reason for God to have vengeance, that if there's any reason for to punish you, okay, it's not really vengeance. It's really he's using the meaning of punishment. If there's any reason to punish you, God will do it.
Right.
And my hand will not be in you. I will not harm you. It won't come from me. God, if God has any intention to punish you because of something which is between us, it won't be me doing it. God will find some way of doing it.
He's leaving it to God.
But I am not, he said, basically saying, even if it is God's decree for you to be punished because of something that you did to me, I will not be the one taking the vengeance, doing the punishment. God will find another way of doing it, but it will not come from me. You have nothing to fear from me, even if it's God's decree that you have to be harmed.
Fair enough. And so he says, as the proverb of the ancients say, Yoel, is what he says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked. Now, the first thing I did was went to my cross-references, but there is no cross-reference for that as far as I can see. It's just a saying, right?
It's a saying that exists. I mean, there's some people that try to link this to an Exodus where it says, you know, if someone by mistake kills someone, God caused this to come to him. You know, it's not really. It might be that the man has some wickedness, so God's punishing him by
delivers them into his hand.
Delivers. You know, it might be that. You know,
so it says he who strikes a man. This is Exodus 21 verse 12 and on. He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. However, if he did not lie in wait, but God delivered him into his hand, then I will appoint for you a place where he may flee.
Yeah, exactly. So the way they look at it is that, you know, the man who was killed, there was some reason for him to be killed from God. There was something that happened that God decreed that he has to die. And then there's a reason for that. That specific person calls his death.
Right.
You know, okay. And that person was being careful. I mean, again, if you have someone who climbs into a car and they're drunk or they're being very stupid behind the wheel and they kill someone, you know, that's one thing. Mm. It's that person is guilty. Mm. End of story. But, you know, what do you do in a case where someone did, you know, was just driving his car and there was something on the road that blew up the tire and the car swayed and lost control and he hit someone and killed them?
Axe in the forest and the head of the axe flies off and hits his mate in the head and kills him accidentally. That's the same sort of thing, right? And that's the example that's given in the Torah.
So that's one interpretation that exists. And then there's also that it might just be some kind of a saying that existed. And really it's just something, you know, it's like a proverb that survived and just in this one place.
Mm. So he says, wickedness proceeds from the wicked, but my hand shall not be against you. After whom has the king of Israel come out? Whom do you pursue? A dead dog? A flea? Therefore, let Yehovah be judge and judge between me and you, between you and me, and see.
There's a term in the Bible called a riv. There's actually, if you go in academic writing, they talk about the riv, which is basically a legal statement. It's a legal term, You know, God will do my riv, will do my argument in the trial. But what's very, very interesting here is that David's being very diplomatic. He's using some terminology that comes from legal cases. And what is he basically saying? He's basically saying, listen, you know, instead of just being crazy about it and chasing me around and trying to hunt me down and everything, if you have anything to say, if there's any, you know, if one man sins against another man, you go in front of a judge. You don't just, you know, try to take vengeance in your hands. It's only in the case of the blood vengeance, which is the family's right, the members of the family to kill someone who killed someone else, one of their members of the family by mistake. Mm-hmm. That's one thing. But he's saying, you know, I haven't really done anything to you. If there's anything between us, let's go for a trial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why are we playing around here?
Judge.
And God can be our judge, and that's basically it. And he's basically saying, you know, what's the point here of chasing me down all the time? Mm. So this is why he's using all this legal terminology. He's basically trying to make a case. He's saying, I have done absolutely nothing. You have no right whatsoever to try to kill me. End of story. Which, by the way, brings up a very, very important issue, uh-huh. because it used to be that in the ancient world, and even today, some people still behave like this, that, oh, the moment you're the one in power, you can do whatever you want. So, for example, in the Talmud, they speak about the whole idea of that a king has the right to walk through a field. If he needs to go through a field to get from one place to the other, he's allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Talmud, for example, says he can't do it. He can't be just walking down the road and say, oh, I want to walk through this field. No, you need a good reason to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's a reason, like, for example, you need to get somewhere, and as a king, you need to get somewhere, it's urgent, then you can go through the field. But again, from what I remember, the owner of the field has the right afterwards to go to the king and say, listen, I have some damage. Can you please pay me for it? It means the king can't do whatever he wants. He's not a superpower.
Sure.
And this is one of the points that David's making.
Mm. And so he says that Yehovah be the judge between us, judge between you and I, you and me, and deliver me. He will deliver me out of your hand. And so it was when David finished speaking, Yoel, these words to Saul, that Saul said, he says, is this your voice, my son David? So he refers to him as my son. I find interesting. And Saul lifted up his voice.
He called him my father, so he says, my son. He's basically saying, I accept what you just said.
Yeah. And Saul lifted up. Yeah, that's right. And Saul lifted up his voice and wept. And when he said to David, you are more righteous than I. Now, that reminds me of, that was Judah, wasn't it? Speaking to Tamar, is that right?
Tzadikah himeni. Yeah, he says that Tamar was acting in a more righteous way than he did, because he prevented Shiloh from marrying Tamar. Mm-hmm. So Tamar did what she had to do. She has a right, and she acted upon that right, though she did it in kind of like a way that we all agree is not really that kosher. But
yeah,
she had a right, and she acted upon that right. End of story.
And he was denying her that right, and he was in the wrong. And so it is here. So he goes on to say, for you have rewarded me with good, whereas I have rewarded you with evil. And you have sworn, or you have shown this day, how you have dealt with me. For when Yehovah delivered me into your hand, you did not kill me. For if a man finds his enemy, will he let him get away safely? Therefore, may Yehovah reward you with good for what you have done to me this day. And now I know indeed that you shall surely... Now, it comes from his own mouth. He says, and now I know indeed that you shall surely be king, and that the kingdom of Israel shall be established in your hand. Therefore, swear now to me by Yehovah that you will not cut off my descendants after me, and that you will not destroy my name from my father's house. Right from his own lips.
He's basically repeating what Jonathan said.
That's right.
Jonathan said. He's repeating the same idea.
Yeah.
It's coming from his mouth. He has a moment of reason.
A moment of clarity, right?
Yeah, and then you would think, like, okay, now they're made up, it's hard to make up and everything. And what happens?
He
takes the oath, and they go their own separate ways.
Yeah, they go their separate ways, and you think, oh, well, that's good, now that's over, and, you know, everything's apple pie now. But we only read in the next couple of chapters that it's not quite the case, but we'll get there.
It's not quite the case. It doesn't really end there. It's just Saul is very, very, very unstable.
So he would have gone, yeah, that's right. So he would have gone home, he would have stewed about it and stewed about it and stewed about it and thought, nah, you know, I guess in perhaps not in a dissimilar way to the way that Pharaoh's heart was hardened. You know, he'd say something and go, okay, it's all right now. But then he'd think about it and go, no, actually, no, you guys aren't going anywhere. But his heart was hardened. So David swore to Saul anyhow, and Saul went home, and David and his men went up to the stronghold. Now, that's the end of chapter 24.
By the way, the word here is the Metsuda, and some people try to connect this to Metsada. The word, it was really that the area of Metsada, the mountain itself, has always been a useful strategic area. And so really David actually went to Masada of today and hid there. And it was only in the Hasmonean period when they actually turned it into an actual fortress. But the name is the same name throughout, or a very similar name throughout the centuries.
Yeah, well, it's not far from En Gedi, right? I mean, I can imagine.
After En Gedi, I think it's like another 40-minute drive or something, half an hour drive.
And so that's kind of cool. I didn't know that. I'd like to think that they did do that. And but in any case, that's where 1 Samuel 24 ends. But I don't want to kick off next week with the next verse. Can we do that now in the first verse of 25?
Yeah, because the next it throws in this verse here, and it's like completely detached from everything else.
It's detached from everything else, and it's a low note as well. And I don't want to start that way. And it says in 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 1, then Samuel died, and the Israelites gathered together and lamented for him, and buried him at his home in Ramah, and David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. So that's kind of sad. But Ramah, now is there a tomb of Samuel in Ramah?
So there's an area where there's a place called Nabi Samuel, and it's actually a hill. It's very exposed, and you can see from it. You can see it from a long distance, and you can see from it to long distances. And they think that the Muslims had this, or someone had this tradition that it's Samuel's tomb, but there's no real way of knowing 100%. It's like, for example, Moses' tomb. There's a Nabi Musa as well, which I was there once before together with Nehemiah and Keith. Mm-hmm. We went in there, and you know, there's no proof this is really it. You know, it's
so. Does it actually say in the first verse, Yoel? Does it say that he was buried, or does it say he was entombed? Or is that can those things be?
No, it says v'ikberuhu, so they buried him. It's he was put into some. They buried him. I mean, again, we have to remember in biblical times, a tomb was unclean. And even today, it's unclean. It was unclean. You don't go in there whenever you want. You go in there only if it's necessary because it makes you unclean. This whole tomb worship thing is really getting on my nerves.
Sure, but this is interesting. You know, I just made the connection. When in some chapters to come, when we hear when we read about the death of Saul, and he goes to the medium of Endor, and
Endor, yeah,
she brings him up, right? We let me just double check. I believe she brings him up.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so he's in the ground. This is where he is. He's buried now. Ramah. Just before we go, Yoel, Ramah. Now, do I recall? Would I have gone past there on the way to Shiloh?
Not really. You have to, the road that goes to Shiloh is Route 60. That doesn't really take you anywhere near there.
Okay. What is Ramah like today?
It's a barren hill. If that's the original Ramah, it's a barren hill. And there's just a structure on the top, which is basically a mosque.
Uh-huh. So it's an Arab town?
Yeah, or? But no, there's no, around the thing itself, there's nothing there.
Okay.
But there's a synagogue there as well. They basically divide up the place or something like that. So it's mostly Jews are there at the moment.
Uh-huh.
Mostly Jews are there from what I remember. But I've never actually been there. I'm not a very big tomb fan thing. I've always been against this whole tomb worship thing. It's not, we're not really worshiping the tombs, but you know, let's go pray at the righteous man's, at Tzaddik's tomb. It's like, no, we don't do that. Even if it's a Tzaddik, he makes you unclean. It's like, you know, going and drishay lamitim, going and praying to the dead. It's the whole thing is just off.
Yeah, no, I agree. I understand what you're saying. And Paran?
Paran, so this might be in the south. This might be more towards the Jordan River. I'm not too sure exactly which Paran this is.
Okay. In any case, that's where David heads off to. And that brings us to the next story there, which is in 1 Samuel chapter 25. We'll continue from verse 2 next week. That was a pretty quick one. How about that?
Yeah, it was straightforward. The chapter wasn't too complex, and he didn't let me schmooze.
You want to schmooze now?
Nah.
So, Yoel Ben Shlomo, his Facebook page is Hebrew in Israel. You'll find him there, and you'll also find him at HebrewNationRadio.com, HebrewNationRadio.com, where he's doing the Torah Teachers Roundtable with Jeff Gilbert. So that's a weekly thing that comes out on Wednesday, if I remember correctly.
Yes, it does.
It does, and you'll also find the link. You do put links on Hebrew in Israel on the Facebook
page. When Jeff remembers to give them to me.
Okay, there
which
it is.
Which is almost never.
You'll find them there as well. Thank you again, my friend, Hebrew in Israel, on the Facebook page. And until next time, dear listeners, when we get back into chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, be blessed, be set apart by the truth of our Father's word.